The earthly world says farewell to Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI as his soul is commended to God.
He said the most important thing is that God always comes first. First, we must seek the kingdom of God.
The personal secretary who spent years at Benedict's side reflects on his time in retirement.
The ability of someone to join with others and to be connected and to listen to others was all part of his quality.
We look at Benedict's particular impact on priestly formation and the Catholic Church in America.
He was a very good pope, a very holy man, and did a lot for the faith, and he will be missed.
And we hear from mourners around the globe about the impact this pope of such deep faith had on their Catholic lives. EWTN News In Depth starts now.
Solemn scene at St. Peter's Square on Thursday as the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, official diplomatic delegations from Italy and Germany, and tens of thousands of pilgrims bade farewell to Pope Benedict XVI. It was a rare requiem mass for a deceased pope, the first time in more than two centuries that a living pope presided at the funeral service for a predecessor. Pope Francis wore the crimson vestments typical of papal funerals in a service Benedict had requested be one of simplicity. The former Joseph Ratzinger died on December 31st. He is considered one of the 20th century's greatest theologians who spent his life defending the eternal truths of the Church. The 95-year-old former pope will be remembered for many things, perhaps most notably for being the first pontiff in almost 600 years to resign his position. But before his papacy and the resignation decision that shocked the world, Joseph Ratzinger had already led a momentous life in service to the Church.
Joseph Aloysius Ratzinger's journey to the chair of Peter began in a small town in Bavaria. He was born in southern Germany to a devout Catholic family in 1927. His father was a police officer, his mother a homemaker. Joseph had an older brother and older sister. As the Nazis rose to power, his family opposed the regime. He was forced to join the Hitler Youth Organization against his will at the age of 14. He was eventually drafted into mandatory service in the German military. He deserted and was briefly held as a prisoner of war. After World War II ended, he studied for the priesthood and was ordained at age 24. He went on to earn a doctorate in theology and to become a professor. By the time of the Second Vatican Council in the early 1960s, Ratzinger was a respected theologian and served as an expert advisor. After the council, he returned to teaching and became vice chancellor at the prestigious Regensburg University. In 1977, Pope St. Paul VI named Ratzinger Archbishop of Munich and Freising. Soon after, he was made a cardinal.
He always did what he was called to. He never tried to become a bishop, he never tried to become cardinal, he never tried to become pope. Nothing of this.
Pope John Paul II appointed Cardinal Ratzinger in 1981 head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the Vatican office that safeguards the Church's teaching. It marked the start of a collaboration with the Polish pontiff that continued for 24 years. Cardinal Ratzinger helped to draft the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the first universal catechism since the 16th century. And as cardinal, he organized the Vatican's response to the sexual abuse scandal, including creation of a special office at the Vatican to handle cases, extending and in some cases eliminating the statute of limitations for victims. After John Paul II's death in 2005, Ratzinger was elected pope in one of the shortest conclaves in modern times. We'll take an in-depth look at the accomplishments and controversies of the 8-year papacy of this gifted theologian and academic in a moment. But he will long be remembered for how his papacy ended in 2013, with the first resignation of a pope in more than 600 years.
It was shocking. It hadn't happened for so long. On the other hand, when you went back and looked at the signs that the pope twice went to the tomb of Celestine V, that he had said in one of his book interviews, yes, a pope can resign, and there are moments when a pope should resign, then it all made a little more sense.
After Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio was elected in March of 2013, the Pope Emeritus continued to live within the Vatican walls at a monastery in the heart of the Vatican Gardens. The relationship between Benedict and Pope Francis was fraternal and respectful. They met on numerous occasions. Benedict XVI spent the remainder of his days in study, writing and praying in the company of his personal secretary, Monsignor Georg Gainswein, and four religious sisters who accompanied him through his papacy.
Ist ja eigentlich gegen seine Auffassung sehr alt geworden.
Contrary to what he thought, he lived to a ripe old age. He was convinced that after his resignation, the good Lord would grant him just one more year. No one was probably more surprised than he was to see that this one more year turned out to be quite a few more years. He was serene, composed, and we who were always around him, who lived with him, could feel that he was on the home stretch and that this home stretch had an end. And he had this end firmly in sight.
Die Zielgerade hat ein Ende. Dieses Ende hatte fest im Blick.
At the conclusion of Benedict's funeral on Thursday, Pope Francis gave a final blessing at Benedict's coffin. The pallbearers then took the coffin into St. Peter's Basilica for interment in a crypt below the main floor. The underground grotto is where many other popes are buried. The Cyprus coffin was placed inside one made of zinc and then into a third one made of oak, featuring a cross and his papal coat of arms. Benedict was buried with coins and medallions minted during his papacy and a document citing his theological and papal legacy. And now we devote the rest of this program to exploring that legacy. Our own in-house expert, former EWTN Rome Bureau Chief Alan Holdren, spent more than a decade following Pope Benedict's every move. He takes a look at Benedict XVI's tenure from day one to the day he departed.
Habemus Papam, Cardinalem Ratzinger.
On April the 19th, 2005, after one of the shortest conclaves in history, the College of Cardinals elected the famed German theologian and cardinal, Joseph Ratzinger, as the successor to Pope St. John Paul II.
In quel momento, come ho già spesso più volte, le parole che sono risuonate nel mio cuore sono state, Signore, perché mi chiede questo? E che cosa mi chiedi? È un peso grande quello che mi pongo sulle spalle, ma se tu me lo chiedi, sulla tua parola accetterò le reti, sicuro che tu mi guiderai anche con tutte le mie debolezze.
From the central balcony of St. Peter's, the new pontiff presented himself as a humble worker in the vineyard of the Lord, taking the name Benedict XVI in honor of Pope Benedict XV and St. Benedict of Nursia. 5 days later, during the Mass to begin his pontificate, he outlined his vision for his ministry as Pope.
Il mio vero programma di governo è quello di non fare la mia volontà, di non perseguire le mie idee, ma di mettermi in ascolto con tutta quanta la Chiesa della parola e della volontà del Signore e lasciarmi guidare da Lui, così che sia Egli stesso a guidare la Chiesa in questa ora della nostra storia.
And that's how his papacy began. It lasted for 8 years. With the new pope came a new style of governance in the Vatican, characterized by sobriety, dialogue, and a return to the essentials. His kindness, closeness, and humility surprised many observers who had long heard he was a rigid and aloof theologian and inquisitor. For Benedict XVI, the biggest problem of our time was the decline of faith, and he constantly reminded us of the importance of actively proclaiming the truth, embracing tradition, and rediscovering sacred scripture and the mystery of the Eucharist. Among his numerous magisterial documents, the first of his 3 encyclical letters, Deus Caritas Est, stood out as an ode to Christian love and a key to understanding his pontificate.
Oggi nella terminologia che si conosce oggi, amore appare spesso molto lontano da quanto pensa un cristiano se parla della carità cristiana. Ma vorrei mostrare che si tratta di un unico movimento con diverse dimensioni, che l'eros, questo dono dell'amore tra uomo e donna, viene dalla stessa fonte della bontà del Creatore, come poi la possibilità di un amore che rinuncia a sé in favore dell'altro, che eros si trasforma in agape nella misura nella quale i due si amano realmente e uno finalmente non cerca più se stesso e la sua gioia, le sue delizie, ma cerca soprattutto il bene dell'altro. E così questo eros che si trasforma in carità, in un cammino di purificazione, di approfondimento.
For Benedict XVI, love would drive us necessarily to seek unity with our fellow Christians, sincere dialogue with other religions, particularly Islam and Judaism, and greater engagement with an increasingly secularized West, inviting it back to its Christian roots. He established a new Vatican department dedicated to once again evangelizing former Christian strongholds. During more than 30 international trips, the Pope connected with millions of faithful of all ages and social classes in person, and they welcomed him enthusiastically. Young people turned out in huge numbers for World Youth Days in Cologne, Sydney, and Madrid, and he challenged them.
How are you using the gift you have been given, the power which the Holy Spirit is even now prepared to release within you? What legacy will you leave to young people yet to come? What difference will you make?
During his pontificate, Benedict XVI presented to the world a church capable of recognizing truth and acting with justice. In the face of scandals that plagued the final years of his ministry, he began a process of legislative and economic reforms within the Vatican walls, particularly to better address sex abuse cases and raise the standards of financial management by the Holy See. Before the world, he took responsibility for the errors and abuses committed by clergy, made humble apologies, and started a path of purification and penance. In 2007, he addressed a particularly difficult situation in China with a letter to Chinese faithful, exhorting respectful and edifying dialogue for unity and ecclesial communion. In his own words, the 8 years weren't easy.
Ci sono stati anche momenti in cui le acque erano agitate ed il vento contrario, come in tutta la storia della Chiesa, il Signore sembrava dormire. Ma ho sempre saputo che in quella barca c'è il Signore e ho sempre saputo che la barca della Chiesa non è mia, non è nostra, ma è sua. E il Signore non la lascia affondare. È Lui che la conduce certamente.
On February 11, 2013, Benedict XVI surprised the world when he announced he would renounce the Petrine ministry.
Non c'è più un ritornare nel privato. La mia decisione di rinunciare all'esercizio attivo del ministero non revoca questo. Non ritorno alla vita privata, a una vita di viaggi, incontri, ricevimenti, conferenze, eccetera.
non abbandono la croce, ma resto in modo nuovo presso il Signore crocifisso. Non porto più la potestà dell'ufficio per il governo della Chiesa, ma nel servizio della preghiera resto, per così dire, nel recinto di San Pietro.
Far from Rome now, Alan joins us from his new home in Beloit, Kansas. Alan, it's so great to have you back on EWTN to share your personal insights about Pope Benedict and the work that you did alongside him. First, tell us about Pope Benedict's character. From the beginning, there were many caricatures of his personality because he was the first German pontiff in a long time. What did you experience in covering his work as leader of the church?
Good to be here with you, Monty. It was those caricatures led to so many misunderstandings. He had this title of God's Rottweiler, and then also the German Panzer Cardinal that he had to get over. Those were public images created largely in the media, I suppose, to sell newspapers, because the people who were closest to him inevitably speak about how meek he was, how he valued his colleagues' input, how he esteemed them, and also how he listened. He was someone who, whoever he had in front of him, it was as if they were the only person on earth. And he would treat every topic that would come up in the office with respect, and then he would come to a decision, seeking the truth at all times. And he led other people to that excellence and to a sense of leadership and responsibility for those same things. People who came across him outside of the office on the streets, he had a known routine where he would cross St. Peter's Square to go back to his home for lunch, and people would wait for him there to speak with him, and he would speak to them. That idea that he was God's Rottweiler was ridiculous in the end. He was such a towering intellectual figure, and yet he was so humble. And that is what my experience with him was as well, is that you had in front of you a person that you knew was seeking your good and the good of every man and woman around him, if only that they would listen.
So humble and so approachable. After the late Pope John Paul II, the global Catholic Church was used to a pretty charismatic leader. And Benedict, he honored that legacy, responding to the shouts of Santo Subito for Pope John Paul the Great. And he waived the usual 5-year waiting period for the sainthood process. Why was the collaboration between those two popes so significant?
Imagine following in those footsteps of John Paul II. He was able to do that, to follow in his footsteps and also to support him because they were such close friends. They complemented each other. You had John Paul II, who was known for being a people's person, for going out into the world and speaking of the Lord. And you have his right-hand man back at the Vatican, holding down the fort, holding down the faith, protecting the deposit of the faith in a way that led to the ministry of John Paul II being more efficacious. He knew that he could count on Cardinal Ratzinger. And if you can imagine teams in the world today, you have great leaders, but you always have a great supporting staff. And Benedict XVI was one of the captains of John Paul II's team.
And Benedict, he did take a different approach to travel as well, being older, but just a different approach as well. He wasn't hiding in the Vatican walls either. What was most significant about his international outreach to you and what you've covered?
Well, it's incredible if you look at how popes travel. John Paul II, Pope Francis, Benedict XVI, all elderly men, obviously at the end of their lives, John Paul II and Benedict XVI, but they went out. Benedict did not shy away from going out into the field, so to speak, speaking to people across the world. And whereas you have Francis, who goes to the existential and geographical peripheries of the world, you had Benedict XVI, who took on secularism and secularized countries head on. He went to places like France, he went to the Czech Republic, to the United Kingdom, to his native Germany. And he went there with the message of Christ in places where you don't necessarily speak about that in public. And here is the most public of figures in the most public of events, not shying away from what was known to be hostile environments, at least how the media depicted the societies that he was going to. I remember the United Kingdom in particular. Here's Pope Benedict going to a country where they're talking about protests, people are going to show up on the streets, nobody's going to welcome him. And from the first day onwards, when they saw who he was, these wall-to-wall broadcasts just showed him with his message And both he and his message were welcomed, even if people didn't agree with him.
That's important. Well, with all of that, his resignation was a shock to the world. Was it a shock to you?
Yeah. I was in a meeting, actually, when I got the call from one of our correspondents. And it was an important meeting. I couldn't exit out of the meeting. So I kept pressing cancel, like stop the call. Like, I couldn't take the call at that moment. And so I walked out afterwards, took a subway, came up out of the subway, and it had happened already probably an hour prior. Made the phone call to that correspondent, and she told me what happened. I stopped in my tracks. It was raining that day, and what was going through my mind was we had prepared for the possibility of the death of a pope. Somewhat, you're never quite prepared for that. That's always kind of in the back of your mind as a sort of a nightmare situation. But we had never prepared for resignation. And so we kind of asked ourselves, what do we do now? And listening to the dean of the College of the Cardinals, who received that message from the Pope himself, he said, this comes as a lightning bolt in a clear sky. And that's what happened with us. If you look back and you look at the clues, you could see that the Pope was preparing us and himself and his collaborators for that. But it came as a complete surprise.
Well, Alan, you continued to cover the Vatican after Benedict's resignation, and you visited with him. What were these encounters like?
Well, the last time that I went to meet with him, I went with my whole family, and that was about a year and a half ago, right before we left Rome. It was in June of 2021, and it was an incredible moment for me to introduce my family to him, and also for them to meet him and get to know a person that I'd always esteemed, and they had always spoken about with me, because I would bring my work home. I got to thank him for his Italian. He's basically taught me Italian. I learned as I listened to him.
Wow.
And my wife is also Italian. And so that was kind of a funny moment. He didn't expect that. But then I also thanked him for his example of faith on behalf of so many people, giving him that opportunity also to receive that those words, because I don't know how many people he would have been meeting with, families in particular at that point in his life. It was also not the first meeting that I'd had with him in his retirement. We had the opportunity as a group from the EWTN Vatican Bureau to visit him in the Vatican Gardens a couple of years prior to that. I think it was 2017. And that was another moment where we were all able to just speak with him sort of openly. He exchanged some gifts with us, spent about 20 minutes with us. And then before that, I had an opportunity just to meet privately with him with a very small group. On every occasion, he was very gracious. On the last of those occasions with my family, he was particularly tickled that we had a child named Joseph just as himself.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Alan, both for your witness and for your coverage and participating today with us.
Thank you, Monty.
Responses to Benedict's death poured in from around the globe, from learned clergy and world leaders to the everyday person. In the United States, President Joe Biden paid his respects in Washington. He signed the official condolence book for Pope Benedict at the Vatican Embassy, formerly called the Apostolic Nunciature of the Holy See. He called it a great honor. Reporter Rizal Rages has more reactions from those who also admired the Pope Emeritus.
From the Vatican.
I feel sad. Yeah, the relationship between the two popes was amazing, so I feel really sad about that.
To France.
Obviously, we're very sad at his passing, but we thought he was a wonderful man and appreciated his pontificate.
To Jerusalem.
I feel really sorry about that, because he was helping two peoples, and it's big loss for the Christian people and the Vatican.
To Pakistan.
So sad news for the Catholic Church and for the whole world that beloved Pope Benedict the 16th has passed away.
Catholics around the world reacted with sadness as the news broke of the death of Pope Emeritus Benedict the 16th. In Germany, where he was born, bells rang to honor the late Pope Emeritus.
The death of Benedict the 16th moves many people. I am sad, but also full of hope. To die at the age of 95, especially if we consider the Christian faith, is also a great grace.
Benedict celebrated World Youth Day in 2008 in Australia, along with thousands in attendance. Cardinal George Pell, the former Archbishop of Sydney, remembers him as a quiet, gentle, pious man.
I'd known him well enough. I admired what he was about. I thought he was very good for the church. And so it was sad to see another wonderful stage in church history ending.
In Washington, D.C., at the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception, the bells were tolled 95 times to commemorate Pope Benedict's passing, and the entrance draped in black bunting as a sign of mourning. During a vigil mass for the solemnity of Mary, the Mother of God, Archbishop Wilton Gregory from the Archdiocese of Washington offered prayers for the repose of the soul of the Pope Emeritus.
This man of extraordinary faith and humble demeanor was a gifted servant of Christ's Church. In all of the many roles that he played during his long life, he never ventured far from his deep trust in God's providence and in God's design.
Rector of the Basilica, Monsignor Walter Rossi, recalls Pope Benedict's visit to the Basilica in 2008, where the late pontiff spent some time praying to Our Lady of Altötting.
Altötting is the national shrine of Our Lady in Bavaria, which is the Holy Father's hometown. And so Pope Benedict had a great devotion to Altötting. When you're with the Holy Father, you're the only person that mattered. He was kind, gentle, gracious.
The Pope Emeritus's chair, the zucchetto he used, and in the sanctuary, a portrait of him along with a papal rose he gave the basilica as a gift, are all on display for visitors.
He was one of the most erudite men that ever was elected to be pope.
I admired him. He was a brilliant scholar and holy man.
I'm sad. At the same time, I'm so grateful. Pope Benedict understood the essence of what it is to love God.
Across town at the Apostolic Nunciature of the Holy See in Washington, officials, ambassadors, and laypeople paid their respect to the late pontiff in writing.
We have opened a kind of book of condolences to inviting people to sign, to express their sympathy, to write a few words and to remember.
Archbishop Christoph Pierre, who has served as Apostolic Nuncio to the United States since 2016, says this is an opportunity for the Church to come together.
Together we may pray for the repose of the soul and to be together, you know, so that we can express our hope, because, you know, thank God for the gift of the Pope, and also express our hope because the life of the Church continues.
Rasal Regis, EWTN News in Depth.
Ahead, the shy man, the respected religious scholar who became the reluctant pope. More Benedict coverage coming up on EWTN News in Depth.
Benedict's ability to point to Christ in a myriad ways and convincingly and compellingly, and to teach that in a way that is accessible and resonates, I think has deeply shaped a whole generation of, and more, of young priests and bishops.
Benedict's impact on the clergy and his widespread influence in the United States, that and much more on the life and times of Pope Benedict XVI when we return.
When Pope Benedict resigned the papacy in 2013, it created a delicate situation in which there were two living popes. Though he was Pope Emeritus, Benedict's influence remained, even as a very different pontiff, Pope Francis, took charge at the Vatican. Many of Benedict's most ardent fans were here in the United States. Reporter Mark Irons takes a look at Benedict's relationship with America.
Pope Benedict XVI's influence has traveled around the world, including the United States. His vast theological work unpacked truth, guided by sound Catholic doctrine, but it was all rooted in a profound love of Jesus Christ. And that understanding of faith leaves a legacy within the U.S. Church among the clergy inspired by him.
He very much formed my mind. He very much formed the mind of those who were with me in seminary, even prior to our entrance, but certainly while we were there.
Ordained in 2016, Father Joseph Rampino is a priest for the Diocese of Arlington, Virginia. He says Pope Benedict's theological perspectives are attractive because they are focused on knowing Jesus authentically.
There's just such an intense desire to see Christ as he is, to see Christ on his own terms rather than on my terms or on our human terms.
As a theological influence and as a teacher on the current clergy of the United States, and particularly the younger generations, I think he's had a tremendous influence.
For more than a decade, Stephen White has focused his work on the intersection of Catholicism with culture and politics in the U.S. Executive director of the Catholic Project at the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., White believes the experience shared by Father Rampino is common among young priests in the U.S. and those currently formed in seminaries.
In the last 10 or 15 years especially, I think you'll find among them the kind of people who really responded well to Pope Benedict.
His impact can also be felt among the U.S. clergy he appointed, like Archbishop Emeritus Joseph Kurtz, who knew Pope Benedict to be a brilliant theologian, but also a man with a humble spirit.
People have said often that he spoke because of his intellect with such clarity, but I would add that he spoke with clarity without a hint of arrogance.
In 2007, Kurtz was appointed Archbishop of Louisville, Kentucky by Pope Benedict, but he'd gotten to know him before that at the Vatican as Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith.
He shook everybody's hand and asked us our name and where we're from. We sat down, and I always remember he said, now, I have some things that I would like to say if there is time. However, first, I'd like to hear if you have any questions. So he was just a gentleman.
I found him to be delightful, intelligent, humorous, and really engaged with us.
Diane Starkovich, the superintendent of Catholic schools in Atlanta, will never forget when she saw Pope Benedict up close.
In 2008, Pope Benedict came to the U.S. visiting New York City and Washington, D.C., and he made a stop here at the Catholic University of America to discuss the role of the church in education.
Starkovich gathered with hundreds of Catholic school educators from around the country to hear from the Pope.
Challenged us, be true to our mission, be authentic, be Catholic, don't forget prayer.
Pope Benedict even left his mark on U.S. politics, meeting presidents during his papacy and then Vice President Joe Biden, who reflected on that visit earlier this year.
And we had a long conversation. He's a great theologian, a very conservative theologian.
Stephen White says though the teachings of popes throughout history aren't focused on political matters, he finds continuity between the writings of Pope St. John Paul II, Benedict, and Francis when it comes to issues that influence U.S. politics.
Yes, there have been different points of emphasis. But if you want to read about the importance of ecology, you can find it in Benedict and Francis. If you want to read about the importance of defending life from conception to natural death, you find that in John Paul II, and you'll find it in Francis.
During his U.S. visit, Pope Benedict stopped at the White House and met with President George W. Bush, who applauded the Pope's defense of unborn children.
In a world where some treat life as something to be debased and discarded, we need your message that all human life is sacred and that each of us is willed, each of us is loved.
In Washington, D.C. and in New York, Pope Benedict acknowledged reports of clergy sex abuse in the U.S. and the pain it had caused.
His record stands on handling child sexual abuse, both here in the United States and globally.
As executive director of the Catholic Project, Stephen White's work now focuses on responding to clergy sex abuse in the U.S. White says though his record addressing abuse was not perfect, Pope Benedict moved the church in the right direction, doing far, far more good than bad, removing a high number of priests from ministry before and during his papacy.
Probably personally handled more sex abuse cases and laicized more priests who are abusers than anyone else in history.
As the legacy of Pope Benedict is realized in the U.S., it could take many years to understand the full impact. But Father Rampino encourages people to get to know the late Pope now through his writings.
He took the Christian truth to which he was faithful out of a great love for God, and he spoke it clearly. He spoke it in a way that was inspiring as well, and he spoke it in a way that was credible.
And for those following the papacy of Pope Francis, Archbishop Emeritus Joseph Kurtz says a link to Benedict can be found through a focus on Christ.
So much of what I think Pope Francis began with was a continuation of the spirit of Benedict, which was really the spirit of Jesus.
Mark Irons, EWTN News In Depth.
With us now is Mark Irons to talk about the nuances of what it's like to have the effects of Pope Benedict's passings here in the U.S. Mark, tell us a little bit about how Pope Benedict impacted the Jewish community here in the U.S. He met with Jewish leaders.
That's right. Well, with the visit to the Park East Synagogue in Manhattan, he made a really a historic visit. That was the first visit of a pope to a Jewish place of worship in the U.S., so that was significant. He met with Rabbi Arthur Schneier, a famous rabbi who's also a Holocaust survivor. So it was a sign of outreach. The U.S. has a very large Jewish population. Pope Benedict talked about the Jewish roots of Christianity. I think it was just one more step, among many really in his papacy, frankly, to bring about healing between our two faith communities where it was needed.
Absolutely, and definitely tying on to the legacy of Pope John Paul II, who he was collaborating
with. That continuity there.
Absolutely. And I know that you also talked about a different kind of continuity.
Yes.
Pope Benedict and Pope Francis on going green being environmentalists.
Right. So many times we look for the differences between popes. Really, there's that continuity. And if you think about it, it was Pope Benedict who, in 2008, was the first to install solar panels at the Vatican.
Oh,
I think
wow.
We have some images here, but we may forget that he was actually dubbed the Green Pope by some. He was also the first pope to have the Pope Mobile become a hybrid. So we clearly see the action behind the words. And a lot has been made about the words of Pope Francis and what he has said about the environment and his care for creation, but a lot of that goes back to Benedict. A lot of his writings, if you look at Pope Francis' encyclical, Laudato Si, Care for Our Common Home, he references Benedict many times in those writings, so a clear connect between those two when it comes to ecology, when it comes to the environment. So good to keep in mind.
Those are important points to consider and remember. Thanks so much, Mark.
You got it.
Up next, a look at how Benedict's German heritage and upbringing influenced his worldview. A discussion with a special guest. Young Joseph Ratzinger's road to the priesthood began in his hometown in Lower Bavaria. The Vatican shares that Ratzinger described his adolescent years as Mozartian, receiving his Christian, human, and cultural formation in a small town on the Austrian border. Ratzinger credited his faith and family for preparing him for the harsh life he would experience under the Nazi regime. After the war, he studied philosophy and theology and was ordained a priest in 1951 alongside his brother Georg. Early on, he established himself as a highly regarded theologian and was a full professor in 1958 at the age of 31. His academic career spanned until 1977 when he became Archbishop of Munich and Freising. He was the first diocesan priest in 80 years to take on pastoral governance of the diocese. His episcopal motto, fellow worker in truth. A man that also grew up in a small Bavarian town, A.C. Wimmer, the editor-in-chief of Catholic news agency's German outlet. He joins us now from Australia to provide a German perspective on Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI's legacy. A.C., it's great to have you with us on this somber moment. Benedict was the first German pope in the last 1,000 years. Did this have an effect on the German Catholic population and identity? Was there a sense of pride from the community?
It sure did, and it sure was a moment of pride. I remember the biggest tabloid newspaper in Germany, the Bild, had a massive picture of the Pope under the headline, "We are Pope, wir sind Papst." That really summed it up, how the whole thing took off here. Yeah.
That's really interesting. The German synodal way, however, is also something that's brewing in Germany, and the desire from some in the German church to change church teaching seems to be something Benedict prophetically diagnosed. Were there signs of this when he was in Germany?
Absolutely. He took that on, in fact, as a young theologian, as a priest, as an archbishop, and then obviously in the Vatican. He knew what was brewing under the surface, what the crisis of modernity, what secularism brought to people. He was trying to deal with it. He formulated responses.
And is it possible that Pope Francis then relied on Pope Emeritus Benedict's knowledge of the German church to deal with this crisis?
Absolutely. Both the people around the Pope and the Pope himself would have communicated with Pope Francis, and all the context that you're seeing in terms of what decisions are being made, you know, in the Vatican, sometimes it's a bit like criminology when we look at it, but it was apparent in what came up to the surface for sure.
a little bit more of not criminology, but just a hypothetical for you. Do you think that maybe the reason that Pope Benedict put in his spiritual will a mention for his hometown, the German people, to remain faithful to the church, do you think that this was related to what's going on there in Germany now?
Absolutely. He was a close observer, even when he had retired into the monastery, Mater Ecclesia in the Vatican, of what was going on in Germany. He commented on it sparsely, and he certainly prayed about it, as we know from his secretary, Archbishop Genswein.
Well, aside from the controversy of his resignation, you also had the sexual abuse scandal during his tenure. A church commissioned report indicated that 4,000 youth were reportedly abused by clergy in Germany, which was the launching point and sometimes the excuse many use for the German Synod on Synodality that seeks to change church teaching. Is this also part of Benedict's legacy?
It certainly is, in particular the fact that he, as the prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, made sure that hundreds of priests, mainly clerical staff who committed abuse, were dismissed from their service. However, there remain questions, as the bishop who leads the bishops' conference in Germany, Bishop George Betzing, has said, about his own role. And we will see in history as it unfolds how things pan out. But it certainly was a defining moment, both for the priest and the cleric, then the bishop, and then, of course, the theologian and pope. That was Benedict. Dealing with that was a huge task. He served under St. John Paul II in that role, and he tried to make amends and change things when he was Pope himself.
Well, I'm sure that he did great work here on earth, but he'll do even more in his eternal rest. Thank you so much, AC.
Thank you kindly.
The View from Rome, ahead. Two EWTN experts, one who knew Benedict for more than 30 years, and a two-time Benedict biographer, join us up next. Welcome back to our special broadcast on the passing of Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI. We're joined now by Joan Lewis, the founding bureau chief of EWTN's Vatican office, and Dr. Matthew Bunsen, the executive editor and Washington bureau chief of EWTN News. Thank you both for being with us. Matthew, you've been in Rome with all of this coverage. Some say that the 24 years that Pope Benedict spent with the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, now the Dicastery on the Doctrine of the Faith, were more influential than his eight-year papacy. Tell us why.
Well, if we look at his life as a theologian and a leader in the church, we can look at four different eras. His time as a theologian, including the Second Vatican Council, his time as an archbishop in Munich and Freising. But then we can look at his time at the CDF, and then we can look at his time as pope, and then we can look at his time in retirement. I agree with the idea in many ways that his time as prefect for the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith was the most influential. Why? Because it was in that position for several decades that he partnered with John Paul II in crafting so many of the important documents in the life of the Church, including, of course, the Catechism of the Catholic Church, but also having that positive effect as prefect of helping to form Catholics, helping the Church also to implement in a very real way the Second Vatican Council 20-some years, 30-some years after its conclusion. And it raises the question in many ways throughout this brilliant career as to one of the questions being asked right here is whether he might ever become a doctor of the church. And we will look at much of his work at the CDF to answer that question. He remains, partly as this prefect for the congregation, one of the greatest theologians in the history of the church, one of the greatest theologians certainly in the last century. One of the open questions about being a doctor of the church is the eminence of your teaching, and you have to be a declared canonized saint. I think there's no argument that he is certainly qualified on the theological side. Only time will tell. It's up to God as to whether or not he will eventually be canonized.
And that's definitely something that Pope Francis could encourage. We look forward to your analysis on that. I know you'll have that soon on the Catholic News Agency. Joan, you're the founder of EWTN's Rome Bureau. You saw our Pope transition from Joseph Ratzinger to Pope Benedict XVI, and you knew him for those 30 years. What was most significant about him?
I think I always approached him just as a person. I think that's not what I do with a lot of people. I didn't think of him as a preeminent, you know, theologian or in his particular role, obviously, at the congregation, although I knew all of his work. I read what he wrote. But it's just as a human being. He was so wonderful. He was so down to earth. He was so, I've often described him as a gentleman and a gentleman. And that's what he was. And when people got to know him, it was, wow, this isn't the man we're reading about. And the gentleness with which he received people. He wanted to be there for you. You came to his office at that moment. How can I help you? I look how he answered the Anglicans in their cry to come into the church as large groups. And he created the personal ordinariate. He listened to everybody. There was some way he knew he could help them.
That's beautiful, and I know it's a legacy that remains for friends and adversaries alike, that he was a gentleman and was very present. Matthew, one of Pope Benedict's greatest phrases was the dictatorship of relativism, a great gift to the church. He found that to be a significant enemy of the church, relativism. How did that change how we view ourselves as Catholics?
Well, we go to 2005, on the very day of the start of the conclave that elected him Pope. He delivered a homily on that very question, on the dictatorship of relativism, where he really coined a phrase that many in the secular media assumed that phrase alone would have blocked him from being elected Pope. It betrays a certain ignorance about Joseph Ratzinger, especially considering that his concerns about relativism, about the impact of secularism, date all the way back to the 1960s when he was a young theologian. You can read about it, for example, in his masterpiece of a book, 1968, Introduction to Christianity. But his concerns then were, this is a major theme throughout his entire life as a theologian and then as Pope. And what he's warning us about, and we have seen come to pass in such searing fashion in the years since his election, is this worry that the church might succumb, or quarters of the church, corners of the church, might succumb to the idea, to the appeal of relativism, watering down the faith in some false hope that we might be able to appeal to broader culture while losing our own identity and really losing the antidote to the very problems of modern society. So Benedict was a prophet in so many different ways, but I think he was also so wise in reminding us about remaining strong in the faith in the face of these great challenges culturally, and the greatest of these right now is relativism.
A prophet and a pastor. Joan, we're seeing Pope Francis give women prominent roles in the church. What can you say about Pope Benedict's stance on the role of women in the church and how he reached out to them?
Well, I think if you look back on it compared to Pope Francis's naming of women and each nomination comes out as a big news story, I think it was probably the understated way in which, for both John Paul, you look at his beautiful letter in 1994, mm-hmm. the letter to women, before we went to Beijing to talk about women. But I think it was more of an understated placement of people in the Vatican, of nuns, of lay women. And you know, when you think about it, in his retirement, who did he choose to be at his side but his longtime wonderful friend and almost son, Archbishop Ganschwein? He chose four consecrated women to spend these almost 10 years with him. That's a very intimate setting, but he just had that trust. And he knew these were the four best people that could be with them. He didn't choose seminarians or priests. So, I think we've seen a lot of them these days. They never sought the spotlight. Neither did he, as a matter of fact, because if there was a man who was humble with capital letters, it certainly was him. But there was a great admiration for what John Paul called the feminine genius.
And a beautiful testament to friendship. Matthew, the media's perception was that Benedict was God's Rottweiler, and a lot came with that loaded phrase. Is that a false characterization?
Well, you asked me a little while ago in our conversation about his role as prefect for the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith. It was in that position that he largely acquired that nickname, along with others such as the Panzer Cardinal. What is so interesting about it is that it is such a misrepresentation and such a false title. Anyone who actually knew him, who interacted with him, who worked with him, understood, A, that he was a gentleman. He was a truly gentle theologian who brought to bear the great work of the CDF. deaf, but in a way with absolute charity, with patience, with forbearance, with really trying to pursue the virtues, and in some cases in a very heroic way. Those who worked with him, those who knew him, would attest to the fact that his patience, especially in dealing with theologians who had wandered away from the truth of the church, was truly exemplary. And he dealt with them, he dialogued with them, he gave them the opportunity to be heard. But at the end of the day, he had to defend the teachings of the church, but he again did so with great charity and patience. So it's a misrepresentation largely spread in the secular media and in a lot of corners of progressive Catholic media, but it's completely false. And I think this week has gone to some down the road in sort of debunking that entire myth as testimonies have been heard from those who knew him best.
Absolutely. A Rottweiler would never have been able to apologize the way he did for the sexual abuse crisis. Joan, last question for you. Rather than going to the peripheries, Benedict seemed to be establishing a post-Vatican II identity for Catholics, looking inward to the church rather than outside of it. In hindsight, he served as a bridge between two popes who focused on reaching the marginalized. Do you see this as true?
Right. Well, you know, I do, because when Benedict was elected, he knew, as the whole world knew, it had even been in print, that he was following in the footsteps of a giant. But the one thing people seem to forget was that Benedict was a man who was eminently comfortable with himself. He knew who he was. He was not going to be John Paul. He was going to be himself. And he was comfortable with that, and he had to be at his age. The age at which he was elected precluded, you know, 4 or 5 trips a year abroad. He made a lot of trips. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could do a whole special on the trips that I accompanied him on. But he made those trips. But okay, I can't continue doing this. People will have to come to Rome. And they did, by the droves. My word, the crowds that attended his Sunday Angelus and so forth were just enormous. They came to see the successor of Peter. And again, he was very comfortable in that skin which eventually aged and forced him to retire.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for this illuminating discussion. I'm grateful that you brought this to bear for us. We'll be right back in a moment. Though Pope Benedict XVI's papacy was relatively short, he leaves a long and powerful legacy of writings and teaching on the Catholic Church. We're forever grateful for that gift. Thank you for joining us for this special edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. We hope to see you again, same time, next week. To close, we bring you inside the Vatican as the world said its final farewell to Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI.